To order at 8:34 a.m. on January 22nd for the Arizona State Board of Podiatry Examiners. Our roll call is physicians present are myself, Dr. Campbell. We have Dr. Foreman, Dr. Yolano, Mr. Rhodes, our public member, is present telephonically. Dr. Cohn, an investigator, is also present telephonically. And our assistant attorney generals are present, Mr. Mark Harris and Mr. Seamus Monahan. Because Dr. Cohn has other thing or another engagement, we're going to begin with move on to does anyone have any declarations of conflicts of interest on any case today? Okay, so we will move on to item 5, which is our investigation files. And 5B, and we will begin with case 19-36-C, which is Dr. Serge Nazarian. Dr. Nazarian going to be present by phone? He's not, and he's not present. I don't see him. Okay, so we will go ahead and have Dr. Cohn give his summary of his findings, and then board members will be able to address him prior to his needing to leave the meeting, and then we can
hear anybody
from our complainant who is present via phone, and remembering that we'll refer to her as KF. So Dr. Cohn, your report, please.
Sure. Thank you, Dr. Campbell. This is case number 1936C. Involves Dr. Nazarian.
You're speaking or not. Cannot hear anything.
John, was
okay.
That you? You're
I'll
not hearing.
I'll try to go louder. Is this better?
Cannot hear anything. If anybody
is this any better, Mr. Rhodes? John, is this any better?
We can
Hello?
Hear you.
Okay. Is it okay with Mr. Rhodes if I continue? Okay, just
yes.
Let me know. So this is, okay. This involves a surgery that was performed on February 1, 2017 by Dr. Nazarian. Patient previously had treatments by Dr. Discount. Dr. Discount's treatments included multiple cortisone injections, and at the time that the patient presented to Dr. Nazarian, she continued to have the same complaint, which was her right great toe painful with movement. Dr. Nazarian, after review and discussion of treatments and care, explained that she had received multiple injections and it was too many to continue to proceed with cortisone injections. Therefore, his recommendation was to consider surgical intervention. And the surgical intervention he recommended was a joint replacement of the right first MPJ. KF did develop complications during the surgical procedure, actually intraoperatively, which Dr. Nazarian associated as a possibility to have occurred from the multiple cortisone injections, which resulted in the bone being a little softer than it should and subsequently fracturing. The patient's complaint was that she felt she could have received additional injections, and that Dr. Nazarian practiced below the standard of care, which resulted in intraoperative fractures of the metatarsal. Dr. Nazarian's response, involved the extent of treatment, which initiated on January 18, 2017, involved the surgical procedure on February 1, 2017, and patients appear to be self-discharged on March 7. 2017. He felt the patient received too many cortisone injections over the prior 2 years, was in excess of 6, and felt that conservative care versus surgical intervention needed to be discussed, but additional injections by himself based on current literature was inappropriate and therefore felt surgical intervention would be required. He also indicated the patient was non-compliant with multiple issues with healing that resulted in multiple issues with healing and postoperative complications from it. As far as medical records review, The initial visit was January 18, 2017. KF presented with a painful right first MPJ, which had been an issue for years. She had received greater than 6 injections in 3 years. The medical history involved no known drug allergies. Social history was unremarkable. Prior surgical history involved hysterectomy and neck surgery. Medications were noted as well. The physical examination, vascular derm, and neuro were all within normal limits. The symptomatic portion of the exam was musculoskeletal, in which the significant pain to palpation of the right first MPJ, as well as with range of motion and an effusion of the first MPJ and a palpable bone spur dorsally. The x-rays were reviewed, and they reveal a DJD, degenerative joint disease of the first MPJ with a dorsal first MPJ spur on the metatarsal. Treatment, as noted, consists of conservative care or surgical intervention. Patient presented January 26, 2017 for preoperative discussion of a right first MPJ joint arthroplasty with placement of an arthrosurface implant. Consent itself was signed on the 26th of January. Surgical procedure was February 2017. My apology, in my report, it's noted as February 11th. The surgical procedure was actually the first. The operative note was pretty standard for performing an arthroplasty, the first MPJ, versus performing any other type of surgical procedures. Unfortunately, while performing that procedure and placement of the implant, it was noted to be a fracture of the medial aspect of the first metatarsal, which was related to the multiple cortisone injections, and was repaired. It was identified and it was repaired utilizing cerclage wiring for that case. Postoperative instructions were to proceed partial weight bearing times 6 weeks, proceed with x-rays, implanting, and cerclage wiring. February 9 was patient's first postoperative visit. It was noted she was doing well. The sutures were removed. It was noted the patient was ambulating somewhat more with a postoperative shoe. The second postoperative visit was on the 14th, continued to note progressing to normal activity. February 28th, the patient was describing swelling. The exam revealed severe pain to the first metatarsopharyngeal joint, right foot. It was moderate pain with range of motion, and there was a limitation of motion. The x-rays were noted to state that the implant was stable. The fracture first metatarsal head, fragment portions of the bone, identified bone callus formation. Treatment was to be placed in a cam walker and remain non-weight-bearing. March 7, was the last postoperative visit. X-rays are noted to describe no changes in description from the February 28th examination itself. This patient was cast for orthotics. This was the last examination and visit with Dr. Nazarian. X-rays are noted just after this, per my review from the 18th, February 1st, and the last set of x-rays were March 7th. I did interview the patient, KF, and I asked if there was a reason KF had discharged herself so quickly, and she stated that she felt Dr. Nazarian was a nutcase, and that was in quotes, and had lost her trust and confidence within his care. Part of this issue involved a complication in which Dr. Nazarian had related that he had never had this type of complication occur below before, and he felt that he didn't know what to do for that complication. As far as Dr. Discount and Dr. Nazarian, the reason that she left Dr. Discount was because of relocating. She felt the current progress was good, and she is now doing a lot better. Concerning an interview with Dr. Nazarian, which I did on November 20, 2019, Dr. Nazarian discussed that He did not want to give additional cortisone injections because of the number of patients he previously received. excuse me. Dr. Nazarian states that he did not have his office notes at the time of surgery, and therefore there was a discrepancy between the specific number of injections patients had received and the noted number that was on the operative report of greater than a dozen. Dr. Nazarian did document he used 40 milligrams of Kenalog. I asked why he did that after the concern with cortisone. He states that the cortisone was not injected into the MPJ or the surrounding area. It was injected proximal, provide some additional assistance in general decreasing the edema that would occur postoperatively. Dr. Nazarian stated it was true. He had never had this type of a specific complication. However, he was very comfortable treating a fractured first metatarsal, which is what this ultimately was, especially when you considered his location of an office in northern Arizona, where it is very common for him to see fractures of a metatarsal. So he felt that it was specific in that he had not treated this specific complication occurring from placement of an implant, but he has treated metatarsal fractures with this ultimate, which is what this ultimately was. There was some additional supporting information, including notes from Dr. Discount. Dr. Discount provided care from January of 2014 through April of 16. His x-rays did reveal degenerative changes and hypertrophic spurring. He had a total of 8 visits, and the patient had received cortisone injections on each one of those visits. As far as the notes from Dr. Hansen was involved from April of 2017, and this involved surgical discussion because of the lack of motion and pain. He did perform surgery on May 19, 2017, to perform a fusion and of the first MPJ and remove the previously placed arthrosurface implant. That was performed with no description of complaints. As far as x-rays from Dr. Hansen, it is noted that the stem of the implant placed by Dr. Nazarian was displaced slightly laterally. The cortical bone for seating appeared to have a fracture with bone callus. Dr. Hansen did proceed with the implant itself with placement of two plates. Throughout the care, it does appear the patient underwent a stable fusion of the first MPJ, and as noted in her discussion, she has gone on to do fairly well now. In terms of my conclusion or recommendations, I felt the case is unsubstantiated. The reason is I did concur with Dr. Nazarian that there needs to be a limit on the amount of cortisone injections that are provided. I do agree that the current literature supports limited injections and that Dr. Discount provided excessive injections. The specific number of injections is up for debate, but 8 within 8 visits, to me, was extensive, and I felt to continue with cortisone, which essentially was already proved non-reliable and non-effective, was appropriate by Dr. Nazarian. Concerning the surgical procedure itself, it is possible that a surgeon could run into a complication. Whether that complication was the direct result of the cortisone injections from the prior physician or was involved in the actual placement, I can't make that decision. But I can discuss that Dr. Nazarian did identify it, did discuss it with the patient, and did attempt to treat it appropriately with use of circlage wiring. So I felt Dr. Nazarian had identified the complaint and had proceeded to treat that complaint in an appropriate manner. The postoperative care was what did involve use of a Kim Walker. It was unfortunate the patient developed a complication, but a complication does not necessarily mean that the patient was practicing under the standard of care within his community. So with the multiple cortisone injections given. I felt his reasoning was appropriate. I felt he recognized the complication itself and therefore, and attempted to treat that complication. Therefore, I felt that the case is unsubstantiated. Thank you.
Thanks.
And I am available for additional time for questions and concerns.
Yeah, I have several, Dr. Cones, Dr. Campbell. I'm in agreement with you in several points, but there are several where I'd like to have some discussion. Yeah, we all know that the cortisone affects now too many injections over a short period of time. It's a chronic issue that was going on. That certainly is an option when you have a destroyed or an arthritic joint to do a replacement. That's certainly an appropriate treatment, and that things can happen in surgery. We've all had complications, and cerclage wire is an appropriate way to fix a fracture. But my questions are and concerns is, making sure that implant was the proper size, because I do believe you indicated you thought maybe that the stem was too large. So, I'm questioning checking out different size, making sure we have the proper use. The discussion of the Kenalog being injected proximal to the surgical site, his operative report clearly states he injected it into the surgical site. I have concern regarding the weight-bearing status. If you have a complication such as that fracture, I believe that patient should have been in a non-weight-bearing status and put in a cam walker right away. The lack of other conservative management, such as maybe an orthotic device, or I don't know if he had surgically discussed the possibility of a chylectomy. Chylectomies were an old procedure, as that's been around and can be quite effective. And a lot of times, yes, you have to go on to other surgeries. We have the question of compliance. There was something also that the complainant mentioned, but wasn't addressed to Dr. Nazarian, was there was something about an injectable drug to promote some bone growth. So what was, there was no discussion of that. He also casted the patient postoperatively when the foot was swollen, her gait would have been altered. So to me, that would not have presented a proper cast that may not have been appropriate at that time. And when reviewing Dr. Discount's notes, there was a history of RSD. Now, it wasn't in the foot. It was, I believe, in her arm, in the complainant's arm. So to me, that could have been a red flag that maybe, be a little bit more conservative first before considering surgery with a history of RSD in another part of the body. He did consent to failure of implants and possible needs for fusions, because we all know that's sometimes how those things end up going. Let me see if I had anything else I wanted to discuss with you. And I didn't see any, there was no discussion if there was any osteoporosis or osteopenia in the patient's history. With the operative report, there was no discussion. His discussion of the presence of what the tissue looked like. I don't know if people aren't doing bone path anymore to see, or if there was synovitis. There could have been another reason too for the patient's synovitis, some other kind of, arthritic condition. So if the base arthritic condition wasn't being treated, I think that's also a component. So if you would respond to all my remarks. Right now.
All right. I will try. And I think I'll start this off by saying, some cases are pretty clear cut. I've done this with us for a long, long time. Some cases are really kind of tough, and that's where it comes up to the board to make a decision on how to proceed. I do agree with you. The implant doesn't look to be sized correctly, and it is questionable whether it is placed exactly appropriately within the MPJ. Some of that could have been from the implant migrating proximally a little bit once that fracture of the medial cortex and the metatarsal happened. So I agree with you. It's It's questionable if the implant is the exact right size, or if the fractures occurred because of prior treatments from other physicians. It is really an up-in-the-air type of decision that I have. When you ask me, when it comes to the making a decision for the board and whether it's substantiated or not, I'm looking at this from my standpoint as the case was performed, the operative court appeared to be dictated correctly, the complication was identified. I do think there's questions as far as whether that implant was placed exactly appropriately, but we've all had cases where something may be a little too large, could have been a little too small, and we could have still ended up with an appropriate result. So I hate to say it, but I defer to you guys, and you would not offend me if you said, well, we disagree and the case is actually substantiated. I came with a conclusion, and I kind of try to be clear as to that's why I made that conclusion. And the recommendation I did make. In terms of things such as arthritis, synovitis, and whether that was present or not, when you clinically looked at the x-rays and you look and review that, we reviewed the history and you see the degenerative joint disease and joint space narrowing, the sclerotic changes in the first metatarsal head, I was comfortable that this was basically a hallux limitus going to a hallux rigidus, depending on your definition. And I feel that he was appropriate to consider this as a surgical option. There may be a component of arthritis, but I don't think that was indicative of the problem. And I think the radiographs bear that out for us. I'm trying to remember your questions in terms of what we have. Proceeding with continued conservative care, I was questionable, and I think hopefully Dr. Nazarian is present to explain his reasoning for a partial weight bearing at the first initially versus non-weight bearing. We'd have to, it should come from him. It is possible you could treat someone partial weight bearing with a fractured metatarsal, but ideally it would be a non-weight-bearing cast. So I don't disagree with you on that. The cortisone, I talked with him personally to ask him because I thought that was questionable. And when I talked to him personally, his statement was that the injection was given proximal. It was not given into the site. Again, I'm going to have to defer to you and the board to decide if he actually went in the MPJ. If he did, that's completely wrong. At this point, if he did give it proximal, which is what he stated he did to me on my conversations, it's okay. It wasn't ideal, and it certainly isn't something I personally would have done. What else did we need to answer?
About the RSD. Sorry. What's your thought on the RSD?
Oh,
the history of RSD.
Well,
doing surgery.
You got to be really careful. You don't want to if you can help it. But if you didn't do the surgery, what else do we do for her? Is she going to continue with pain? I don't think the continued cortisone injections is a good way to go. So I think that had to be ruled out. And realistically, once that's ruled out and she's gone through things such as shoe changes and accommodation, I think you're left with surgery. It did not ultimately result in in RSD. She even underwent that additional procedure after.
Yeah.
So I think he was okay to do it, but it is certainly an additive risk to anybody when we have RSD that's been in the history.
Okay. I think that's all my questions. Thank you, Dr. Cohen. Well, Dr. Yolanda, your question?
My biggest problem was the weight bearing, because if I see the metatarsal fracture, I know with the arthrosurface, you want to get the patient walking and moving the joint as soon as possible. That could have been done through physical therapy instead of weight bearing. Partially, this is not getting the patient weight bearing, and that's my biggest concern with this case.
Uh-huh. And I won't argue with you. I'm not... in my opinion, I'm here to investigate, kind of give you the facts, kind of what I saw in the case, and then give you a recommendation. And I truly think this is a case that it's got to come. I gave you a suggestion as far as unsubstantiated, and I gave you reasons for why I think it could be unsubstantiated. But you can look at this and say he didn't put the patient weight-bearing immediately, and that contributed. How much that causes some of the other issues. Is Dr. Nazarian on the line with us? Because I'm not aware. I think it's a question that we need to direct towards him, because I won't defend the partial weight bearing. I can't.
I got no other question.
Mr. Rhodes? Oh, he might be on.
Yes.
Do you have any questions for Dr. Cohen, Mr. Rhodes?
No, I just had concerns about the partial weight bearing is all.
Okay, thank you. All right, so since Dr. Cohen has to go to another commitment, thank you.
I can stay.
You want to stay? Okay.
I can give you another 10 to 15, 10 and at 15 minutes I'm running. So I'm okay to I would say to 9:15 to help if
okay.
I can. So
okay.
I'll stay on the line till then.
Perfect. Okay, so then we will go ahead and we can hear now from the complainant. Remember, referral to yourself only by your initials, KF. Are you there, ma'am?
Yes, I'm here.
So if you could give us a summary of your complaint, please.
Okay, well, I went in for the surgery. I really wanted to have another injection. I'm feeling 100% better after Dr. Hansen took care of this. Well, not ever 100%, but I'm certainly much better than I was then. But I went in to have an injection so that I could play golf, and I only get injections maybe every 6 months. I certainly wasn't going in monthly or, you know, every 3 months or anything. I hadn't had one for quite a while. And he said, no, he wouldn't do the injection. And I thought, okay, fine, I'll just do this and be done with it, not realizing what I was getting into. And I'm sure that this thing was, the size of the implant was much too large for my toe. It was overstuffing without a doubt. And when he came out and told my husband, he said to him, I'm not sure what I should do. He said, I should cast it. Maybe I shouldn't cast it. I'm really not sure what to do. And my husband looked at him and said, I'm a civil engineer. I've never taken any classes in biology. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. He said, you need to figure this out. And I did walk on it for a while because he told me to. He didn't have an X-ray machine in his office. And every time I would say to him, I really think we need to do an X-ray and see what's going on. And I had to really push for that and go over to Zyman Med to get things done. And that's why I left him. I felt like he was doing nothing to help me, and I was still in a lot of pain. And when he said he had a pharmaceutical person coming in with some kind of a new experimental drug, and he thought it might be good for me for my bone, he said, can you come back tomorrow and pick it up? And I said, well, of course. And I got back there, and it was self-injecting, which I didn't have a problem with doing anything like that. But I got home with it, and I'm looking through it, and it had been expired by 3 or 4 months. And I called his office and said, first of all, this is an experimental thing, and secondly, it's already expired. I am not doing this. So I brought it back over to the office. But, I mean.
Ma'am, did he talk to you about, did he talk to you about that product? Do you have the name of it?
No, I don't. And my daughter has even said to me, Mom, you should have taken a picture of it and written it down. And I said, well, I just wanted to get rid of it. I don't know what it was. The pharmaceutical rep was there when I went in the second day. I met with her, but I don't even know what company it was. I don't know whose it was, Pfizer, Lilly's, I don't know. And then to say that the swelling pain were only found at my third post-op visit is a complete fabrication. I mean, or to say that I had moderate pain, that wasn't, I mean, it was terrible. It was unbelievable what I went through with this surgery. And we moved to Prescott so that, yeah. Can my husband say a couple things? Because he was there at the surgery. This is DF.
Hey, a couple of things. Kathy just talked about that experimental drug.
Can you refer to her by her initials, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. KF, said that she just talked about the experimental drug, and she didn't take it, and she told you why. But the fact that he was prescribing it, I mean, to me, is ironclad proof that he knew the bone wasn't healing. Well, if he knew the bone wasn't healing, why was he letting her walk on this? She ended up walking on a broken bone because her next surgery to put those plates in that Dr. Cohen talked about was a little over 3.5 months after the initial surgery. She walked on a broken foot, broken bone, for 3.5 months. Shouldn't Dr. Anna have done something about that? And he didn't. I mean, you talk about her letting, weight-bearing too soon. He didn't fix her. And it turned out it wasn't just broken at the end of the 3.5 months. The wire had broken, so it wasn't doing anything. There had been zero healing, and the wire was still broken. It makes no sense. You look at the timeline. February 1st is the surgery. February 14th, his notes, Dr. N's notes say return to normal activity. February 28th, it says swelling started 3 days ago. March 7th, it says swelling started 3 days ago. Well, it can't be true in both of those, so one of those is wrong. But then he wrote, it's her fault for too much weight bearing. She did exactly what she was told to do. And when he came to the operating, what she said, when he came into the waiting room and he said, I should cast this because of a broken bone, but I have to leave the bone, the knuckle, the joint free to move. I don't know what to do. I mean, if I should have known, there was a red flag right there. And but.
Okay. Thank you. We'll go.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, does KF have anything further she'd like to address? Because you basically, you repeated a lot of your same concerns, which, thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to let us know, KF?
Yes. We moved to Prescott in October of 16, just a few months before this happened, to enjoy retirement and an energetic outdoor lifestyle, including hiking, golfing, walking a mile into town. We bought a house a mile from town, and I wasn't able to participate in any of this. I never golfed again. In January of 17, my toe was bothering me, and I needed another shot, so I went to see Dr. Ann so that I could be ready in the golf league. And this fiasco transpired. We love an active lifestyle, which has not been able to do since. We love the four seasons of Prescott and the foot being able, to walk. And with the surgery and the snow and the ice, I couldn't do any of these things. And I realized that I was never going to be 100% better. So we actually sold our house in November of 19. And we now have an RV where I can see things, but I'm not able to get out and actually physically walk with my husband on a lot of the paths or trails.
Do you feel like you were pushed into surgery, ma'am?
I do, actually. He said to me, you absolutely have to have surgery. He said, I really feel you can never do any more of these injections. I mean, my whole life has changed because of this foot. I have to go out and buy all new shoes, all new boots, and I can't walk for long. I take my granddaughter's black, I know this is crazy, but I take them Black Friday shopping every year. It's a tradition. In the last few years, I've had to sit in a chair in Nordstrom's, thank God. I sit in a chair in there waiting for them, and I sometimes go out to meet them while they're trying something on, but I can't keep up with them or walk around. And it's been really difficult.
Yes. Did Dr. Hansen put you in an orthotic after after the fusion?
He put me in a cast for a while, and I was on one of those Roly Neal things or whatever for a few weeks. And then eventually, when he took that off, he did put me in a couple different, one was like up almost partway up my leg, and the other one finally was a shorter one. But
are you wearing anything in your shoe to help your foot mechanics or anything, support your foot or make you more comfortable?
No, I just make sure that I have really, really good shoes. I only buy good shoes and I can walk for a while, but not for a long period of time.
I'm going to ask now, ma'am, if my other board members have questions for you. Gentlemen?
Besides the surgical procedure, did the doctor explain other alternatives besides the surgery?
No. No.
He didn't suggest...
And in his notes, he put that he did casting of my foot and what was the other thing?
Braces
and all, and the trying wider shoes. None of that ever happened, ever. None of that was discussed. That's why I left there. I felt like I was getting nowhere. He wasn't doing anything, nothing. And like I said, when I wanted to have x-rays or anything, he didn't have a machine there. I had to go and have it, which I didn't mind doing. But why should I, the patient, say, can we take an x-ray and look and see how this is going?
Before the course that you saw Dr. Nazarian and you had the shots with Dr. Discount, did you do any shoe modifications, orthotics, or anything prior to that?
No, nobody even suggested that. I just would go about every 6 months. I'd get an injection. It would last me for quite a while. I didn't have any reason, and Dr. Discount was great as far as his injections and everything. And at some point, he said, you may want to do the surgery. And I said, I don't want to raise my hand for surgery of any type at all. I don't like this. And... Nazarian seemed to put me on the fast track to surgery. In the very first visit, he told me that on January 18th, he said, no more injections, you need to have surgery. And on the pre-op visit, 8 days later, I was in pre-op, 8 days after. And then the surgery was February 1st.
But his notes from January 18th say he wants to be conservative.
Yeah, on the first visit, he said he wants to be conservative, but he really said I needed surgery.
Went back and doctored.
Okay. Thank you very much for participating with us. We appreciate it.
I have one more comment. He went back and doctored his notes because the surgery was February 1st, he also says that I had an office visit on February 1st. Well, that never happened.
Okay. Thank you very much.
The notes are very inconsistent, very inconsistent. But I just hope that this doesn't happen to anyone else. I mean, it really is, it's a horrible thing. I'm sure things could be a lot worse, but it's really not very good. Can my daughter say something?
No, we've had your husband because that was fine. He was probably present with you on most things. So you're the complainant and you're the primary person that we wanted to speak with. So we certainly appreciate
you
participating. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
So, gentlemen.
Okay.
I think, we've all, as we discussed and with Dr. Cohen, that certainly those are options. The kind of surgery he did. I mean, he could have, he could have done a chylectomy. That was an option. He could have, I think conservative management should have been really addressed, particularly because when I saw the history of the RSD in the right arm, that's a red flag to me, that there could be issues, even though it's in a different part of the body. That's, And the fact that when we do those kind of surgeries, that's a common, can be a very common complication, fracture of the metatarsal when you're placing an implant. But, and I felt it was appropriate that he used the cerclage wire to fix it. But I, and the question to me too is saying you injected steroid proximal, but when your op report says enter, you know, into the surgical site, because we don't, the doctor is not here to give us his side, and the fact that the post-operative care too is inappropriate for when you have, if you're that concerned, if you've got somebody with a fracture, and that's, you know, what our big toe does for us in gait, et cetera, that it should have been more properly treated.
I agree with the post-op was not, she should have been weight-bearing, non-weight-bearing during the surgery of the metatarsal fracture.
And, Mark, because the doctor was supposed to be present, and he's not here, and I, you know, that kind of says something to me.
Dr. Polakoff?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Dr. Campbell?
Yes.
I'm going, if it's okay with you, and I don't think I could provide any additional information.
No, I think it were fine. Going,
okay, thank you for
allowing
me to leave a little bit.
Thanks for participating, Dr. Cohen.
Not an issue. I will talk to you later this month or so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, when somebody's in giving due process, but he had every opportunity, said he was going to be here. So I don't know how y'all feel, you know. He's not here to defend himself, but if he had really an interest, he would have been here.
Well, one of your options is to remand this to an informal interview. I don't know how often you do that, but that will give him an opportunity to, you know, appear before you. It is voluntary, but at the end of that proceeding, you have all of your options available to you. If you believe that this doesn't rise to discipline, you have disciplinary options available. If you do believe that it rises to discipline, you can go ahead and adopt findings of facts, conclusions of law, and an order. With respect to the disciplinary order, though, you would be limited. You wouldn't be able to suspend or revoke. If you felt that the conduct warranted such consequences, then you would need to remand it to formal hearing. So that's an option for you. If you don't want to do that, and you don't believe that you need to hear from the licensee this morning to take action, you can certainly, you know, move forward with whatever you think is appropriate. The only thing that you could do, you can't do though, is unilaterally impose discipline. You would be able to, of course, do any of your non-disciplinary options, but you could offer him a consent agreement if you do believe that he fell below the standard of care in this particular case, and offer him a consent agreement. And, you know, if not signed, of course, you know, move it forward to either a formal interview or a formal hearing. So it's really up to you. You can also just continue this stage of the investigation and request that he appear before you next month. But that seems to be, you know, just kind of kicking the can another 30 days down the road.
I'm not in favor of that.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'd like to hear from the doctor.
Hmm?
I'd like to hear from Dr. Nazarian.
Well, then it appears then that then our only... Since, you know, if we do that, then we have to push this out another month. And, you know, I know there was some, prior, you know, if we have scheduling issues, but if we would go then directly to an informal interview, that would.
Yeah, informal. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So we would just need a motion to offer him the opportunity to participate at an informal interview, and I suppose if not accepted, we bring it back to the board for further consideration of either remanding it to formal hearing or offering him some sort of consent agreement, whether it be disciplinary or non-disciplinary?
And I know it is, you know, prerogative. They don't, you know, you don't have, when you have a complaint, you don't have to come.
That's correct.
So, you know. Now, if reminding me, if that is not court reported.
You know, that's board, you know, I'll defer to the board on that. We certainly need to make an audio recording of it, because at the end of the day, you could take discipline, and if you do, then that discipline could be subject to an appeal. And so we would need to create an administrative record of that proceeding.
Make a motion for an informal hearing. Dr. Nazarian.
It's an informal interview, right? That's the proper.
No, it's in the statute. It's referred to as an informal hearing. The wording is a little bit different with every agency, but it's in essence the same thing. It's an informal. He'll appear if he has counsel, and you'll be given the opportunity to ask him questions. And he'll certainly have every opportunity to defend his actions in this case.
Second.
Any further discussion? Mr. Rhodes, do you have any comments in discussion?
No, I'm good with it.
Okay, great. So we'll take
Excuse me, this is DF, and I'm not sure if I'm supposed to interject here.
No, not at this point.
If there's another hearing, we'd like to be at it.
Well, okay, well, I'll tell you what, sir. After we go through the current status of this case, our AG, Heather Brodus, would be informing you of things. Okay? She'll keep you up. And we have, I believe there was there some issue as we've got current address for you?
Yes, there was an issue, but I gave Heather everything.
Okay. So it's been moved and seconded that Case 19-36-C be moved to an informal hearing by Dr. Foreman, seconded by Dr. Iwano. We've had discussion. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Opposed? Okay, so moved. Thank you all very much. All righty. We'll move on to our next case. We're going to go ahead to case number 19-33-B, which is Dr. David Lee. Doctor is present with counsel Mr. Souther.
Yes.
All right. And this case, the investigator is Dr. Polakoff. So, gentlemen, actually.
Switch, wait for her.
Switch places, I'm sorry. Dr. Polakoff will give her report first and.
Good morning, board. This is Dr. Polakoff, case 1933B, David Lee. The patient ended up with a severe burn from a cold machine, and there was a malpractice action from this, which did involve Dr. Lee, the hospital, the cold machine company, and other defendants. In review of the records, the burn on the patient's foot was from where the ACE bandage stopped to the end of the toe. So because of that, I am basically combining the information from the report and from the nature of burns and saying that that area possibly was not as padded as the other areas of the foot. And it says in the notes that it was wrapped with an ACE bandage with the cold machine. So I am substantiating this report for lack of padding to the forefoot. It's a very unfortunate outcome that the patient had had because of the burn, which is an amputation. And I read in the notes that Dr. Lee is no longer using this product, but unfortunately this happened, and the supposition is that the padding was not adequate from the end of the ACE bandage to the toe where the burn occurred. Any questions?
Dr. Polakoff, there was some indication in, I think it was during a hospitalization, did they ever discover, was there any coagulable or blood coagulation problem or anything underlying this young patient?
Affected this case.
And of course, you know, when you read expert witnesses, they're going to conflict with one another.
Right.
So that was, you know, and obviously it seems like, you know, there was the product liability issue was quite a problem here. Let me see what I had in question.
And the burn marks were distinct from the end of the ACE bandage distally.
And this case ended up settling. So, too, I think if I remember reading, there was a first machine that was defective, and then they waited. There was like a six-hour time frame before another device was. I'll have to ask the doctor, but I think I read somewhere about that. So, do you gentlemen have any questions?
No.
Mr. Rhodes. Mr. Rhodes?
No, I'm using one as we speak.
Okay. So now, doctor and attorney. Thank you, Dr. Lee, Mr. Souders. So are you gonna, do you give a summary and then we'd hear from the doctor if we have questions for him?
Absolutely, I think
we do introductions.
Oh, yes, this Mr. William Souders is the attorney and this is Dr. David Lee.
Thank you. Thanks. I think I'm probably the best historian procedurally in what happened in the lawsuit. It was a obviously very, very litigated. We had lots of experts in the case. We had Dr. Lee as the practitioner defendant. We had the manufacturer of the equipment, and then we had the durable medical equipment supply company, the sales folks, who were defendants in the case. The plaintiff had really what I think are two competing theories that they were able to advance all the way through settlement, I think, which forced the settlement, where you either had a defective device and perhaps negligent promotion of the device, negligent selling that device in the many practices, not just Dr. Lee's, or on the other side, you had allegations of really straight medical negligence in the selection and application of the device. I think one thing that Dr. Lee explained very well during the course of the lawsuit, specifically during his deposition and on video, as far as the padding of the foot goes, I think Dr. Lee will tell you as you ask because I think that was important to Ms. Prokhorov, or Dr. Prokhorov, excuse me. He really padded the foot inside the boot, and one of the And that really came out through his demonstration during his deposition. I know he'll be happy to discuss the amount of padding. This case was incredibly interesting, you know, certainly to me, who spends a lot of time doing medical legal work, and I would think certainly to all of you who focus on the extremity, the feet. This became a case of, was it frostbite or was it non-freezing cold? We had an expert from Stanford on behalf of all the defendants we could agree on causation, where what was this trench foot? And a lot of the studies that we had to rely on went back to the early 1900s and the work that was done post-World War I in England addressing trench foot and that non-freezing cold, the long exposure to moisture. Secondly, we looked at the British troops who landed in Grenada in the late 80s, where there were still, even with modern materials, cases of trench foot that developed. One thing that we learned in the case was that moisture has to be present for trench foot to develop, for not a non-freezing cold injury to develop. There was no evidence in this case that there was any moisture exposed to the skin in Ms. Featherston's foot. You were accurate to point out that there was a issue with the delivery of a malfunctioning or non-usable cold therapy device that was delivered to Ms. Featherston post-surgically. She's from Tucson. Sorry, LF. LF lived in Tucson. Her folks lived up here. Her father was going to help her with her recovery. She was to be non-weight-bearing, stop me anytime, 55 minutes out of every hour. So she was going to need considerable help at home. The cold therapy device was delivered to her home a day or 48 hours before the surgery was to be performed. She was going to be recuperating in North Scottsdale. Dr. Lee's office is in the Northwest Valley. The device was delivered by the Durable Medical Equipment Company. The patient education was done to the father, not to LF. LF, just treated as my opinion, as a 40-year-old adult, was particularly dependent on her retired father. That seemed like a comfortable thing for their family, for dad to take the education, not the daughter. Ultimately, she was to be on the cold therapy 30 minutes on, 30 minutes off, at the recommended temperature, which I believe was 47 degrees Fahrenheit. That was pre-programmed by the delivery company, the DME company. When she returned home, there wasn't any evidence that they didn't plug it in the right way and flip the switch. Dad was some type of engineer, certainly qualified to flip a switch. And then it would run 30 minutes on cold, 30 minutes off at that temperature. It wasn't working. They followed through. They made a phone call to the DME company and said, your device isn't working. The way it turned out is these guys actually, the delivery guys were separate from the sales guys. The delivery guys drove around in the back of their cars, and they were able to drop a new function one off, test it out, and off and running. Ultimately, a lawsuit was filed with these competing theories, both sides hiring experts. We hired Dr. Freed as a standard care expert on behalf of Dr. Lee. Dr. Freed looked things over and found that, you know, the care and treatment that was provided, the patient education. Dr. Lee wrote his cell phone number on the informed consent. He went through it. The informed consent form traditionally dealt with ice bags, but certainly the use of the cold therapy device was discussed in Dr. Lee's office preoperatively. And then at patient education, again, was done by the DME company that had an extraordinary amount of these devices in the marketplace. What did we learn through the lawsuit? What did we learn towards the end of the lawsuit, almost right before the settlement conference? There had been other claims involving this device for cold injury. I guess I would have called it frostbite before this case, or non-freezing cold. But now I'm particularly comfortable just saying cold injury, perhaps cold injury. That's essentially the genesis of her complaint. Dr. Lee is certainly best suited to discuss the medicine.
That was helpful. Yes. Yeah, and as in reading all the, you know, the documents, the fact that discovery was never completed prior to going to settlement conference, right? That so you don't, we don't always have the whole story here.
Just to answer on the padding, I did read Dr. Polakoff's report. It was good, but the padding, the ACE bandage was dressings first, cling, and the amount of dressing I use is a whole 12-pack. So it was on the bunion area, and then we did another 12-pack or a partial pull tack on the Taylor's bunion area. So they had the dressing, which is about, what, a half inch thick, the cling, then the standard just loosely wrapped ACE bandage, followed by the wrap, which has an ACE, which has, you know, short bands just to hold it on around the foot. The actual pad does not rest on the ACE because it's a harder type of plastic, so it kind of bubbles over the area, so it doesn't actually sit in direct contact with the ACE bandage. And that's what we demonstrated at the deposition, was that this cold pack theory, this cold wrap doesn't actually, I'm not tightening it around the foot. It, actually, if you see that product, it's a stiffer type of plastic, so it doesn't lay right against the skin, and it certainly didn't, wasn't even near the skin. The areas that it actually was in contact close to the skin was in the ankle, which had suffered nothing as far as frostbite.
So there was, how much space do you think it's, so it's like it's bubbled over?
It was bubbled
it,
over,
right?
Only like a half an inch away from the top of the foot.
And two, when you think about it, the temperature's going to change. I mean, the temperature's going to change, okay, as it goes down through that dressing. It's going to be higher than, what, 43 degrees. You know, again, back to the, you know, that your discovery wasn't totally complete. Did you ever find out, was there a hypercoagulable disease? Was there an autoimmune illness, something underlying that nobody knew about?
First, I admitted her, like, literally in 3 hours, and we already did a decompression because she came in very swollen. I mean, it was as swollen as a football when she came in, and that was postoperative. And she never called at all during that period of time. We did get a vascular consultation and immunologist to see if there's hypercoagulability states, and everything came back normal, literally normal.
This device, how far does it extend on the foot when you put it on?
It's kind of a figure eight wrap, so you're going to have the wrap right here around the front of the foot, and then does have another. Do you have a piece of? Let's draw it out for you. It's easier to describe. So it looks like this. This part wrapped around the foot, and this goes around the ankle, and it creases about the ankle level. This part, there wasn't even an ACE wrap around it. That was around the ankle. There's just the wrap of the cling around the ankle. This part here is where was around the top of the foot on the dorsal aspect, and that's where the ACE bandage and the cling and the gauze were all at.
And how far distally does that the wrap go?
Oh, it goes to med head.
The med head?
Yeah.
Okay. Then touch the toe, the distal phalanx.
And I believe you might have even remarked that maybe there was not enough elevation in the extremity postoperatively, and that contributed to a problem.
It was a theory.
Okay.
I mean, you're trying to, when you're going through it, you're trying to explain why this might have happened. That was what it was.
And you apply this in the operating room?
Yeah, I do it myself.
So did they in-service you? I mean, did you have a lot of in-service with the cold, with Bacutherm before in your office, or?
Yeah, I did, and I've used these for a long time, thousands of patients in the past.
And the if you would please comment on the appropriateness of the cold pack in addition to the pain pump, opioid, as far as that's your typical.
Used to be.
Well, at that time, yes, I understand. Yeah.
Yes, we would use cold therapy. I would do a pain pump proximally to the surgical site, not at the surgical site, but just a ring around it proximally to the incision. And it would usually pain pumps, the Lamarcan provides maybe 60% anesthesia for the period of time. And then we just use hydrocodone.
So how long did you use your pain pumps?
It only lasts about two and a half days. Yeah.
And when the patient was, did you saw patient upon discharge and all that? And everything was intact, all the with the, their, with the camel boot.
Oh, you mean at the hospital?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I visited the patient right afterwards. I mean, I didn't see her at the time she walked away because I had other cases that day. That's what you're asking.
Yes.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Rhodes, do you have any questions?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Well, and my feeling here is, you know, this is obviously, yes, it's certainly not a situation that you want to have a patient experience, but, and I, Dr. Lee had no, I mean, he's made changes, obviously, too, in his office. I think you said something about more education regarding and materials for your patient regarding, like, icing post-op, and am I correct in saying this, that you...
Well, that already.
Right, I mean, it was but I'm saying, but did you change anything or do anything additionally now for
No,
your
we
patient?
Just stopped using it, and then, again, right. stopped using it just because of the situation, but we still, in my post-operative, as you see, my post-operative instructions do already have instructions on how often to use it, when to use it, and... So I didn't change that. I didn't think that part applied because that was not with cold therapy units.
Well, like I said, I think, you know, it certainly is an unfortunate event that occurred, something that nobody wants to have to go through, both you and your and the patient. But I don't think that, I mean, you're, how can, you know, how to hold somebody responsible for a product?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it seems like this was a lot of product liability issues. So.
Make a motion to dismiss. Case 1933.
Second it.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Any other discussion on the matter? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So.
Aye.
Were you in favor of Mr. Rhodes or opposing?
Yes. I'm in favor of dismissal.
Thank you, sir. I was just trying to make sure we're on the same track here. Okay, so moved and seconded and then voting. Thank you.
Thank you.
You guys okay? Okay?
I'm okay.
Okay, all righty. All right. Actually, here now we have... Right, so we're going to move on because we have the counselor. Oh, here, let me see. Get my on the. All right, next, let's move on to 19-39-C, which is Dr. Keith Bangart. His attorney is present, Mr. Souders. Dr. Bangart is here. Our investigator is Dr. Polakoff, so she's going to go ahead and give us her report. And we don't have, Heather, there's no complaint. Dr. Polakoff.
Good morning, Board. This is Dr. Polakoff on 1939C, Keith Bangart. The patient, SB, filed a complaint stating that she is having severe pain, numbness, and her toe is dislocated. She had surgery to remove a callus on the fifth toe and would never have done it knowing the bad results that occurred. She stated that she presented Dr. Bangart with a callus on the little toe. He talked me into having procedures on four of my toes, not my big toe. Now she has pain with every step. He put a Band-Aid on the middle toe, which was starting to elevate and is numb, and to this day she still has to keep a Band-Aid on it after the surgery. He did offer a treatment that she would have to pay $100 per treatment, that she would need 3 to 5 treatments for him to decrease the nerve pain. She went to another physician who told her that she needs multiple surgeries to correct what occurred to her foot. The allegation is harm to the public for performing surgical procedures that did not solve the chief complaint, resulting in patients in ambulation. I did substantiate this report, and the patient presented with a callus and a pronated fifth toe with a fusion to the middle and distal interphalangeal joints. There is a spur present on the lateral aspect of the fifth toe. She ended up with tendon releases on toes 2, 3, 4, and 5. The callus is still present today on toe 5, and the pain to toes 2 and 3 are severe with shooting nerve pain. It is this investigator's opinion that a visible spur, which is present on the lateral fifth toe preoperatively and present on the lateral fifth toe postoperatively, should have been addressed differently. The justification for performing tendon procedures on all lesser toes and not removing the spur is in question. Upon review, the patient, during her very first post-op, surgery was on 2/12/2019. Her first post-op was 2/15/2019. She had a sharp pain when walking with burning, and her fifth toe had callus on it that needed to be debrided. During her fourth week post-op, the callus reoccurred to the fifth toe, which needed debridement, and an injection was needed to the interspace third to decrease the pain. 8 weeks post-op, the sharp pain decreased, but there was still pain and swelling to the second and third interspaces, which she felt like a ligament strain. She had another therapeutic injection to this area with Kenalog and dexamethasone. On 4/25, she had no improvement and was offered shockwave therapy, which she turned down because of the cost, and it was not covered by insurance. When I spoke with the patient, she stated that the third toe is now elevated above the second toe. It is hammered, and the fifth toe is still under line and pushing up on the fourth toe. In review of the financial information, the doctor debrided the callus lesion and put some silver nitrate on the area, and x-rays were taken the very first visit. On the second visit, 2 weeks later, he destroyed the lesion again with silver nitrate. And on the third visit, 28232, a tenotomy flexor toe, and 28232 of the second, third, and fourth digits with a capsulotomy of the, I believe, the fourth or fifth. On 3/8/2019, 17110 destroyed lesions, another trigger point injection. In review of all the records and the x-rays, I do believe that the main problem of the fifth toe underlying spur was not addressed. He, I'm assuming, tried to reduce the curvature of the fifth toe and relax the digits by the tendon procedures, but in this case, it did not take. The patient has already gone through multiple surgeries for this and is looking for more surgery down the road. The case I found was substantiated.
Dr. Pollock?
No.
Was there any pain in the second and third toe prior to the surgery?
The patient denies any pain to the second, third, or fourth toes prior to surgery. The only toe was lateral fifth, where the corn was present, which she felt walking without shoes was worse, with shoes was a little bit better.
Dr. Polakoff, I'm trying to pick out the exact visit, but there was a visit, I believe, when the surgery occurred in the office, the porokeratosis was again debrided and treated with the silver nitrate the same time the tenotomies were done.
Yes.
And you talked to me. So, and what the complaint has gone on to seeing doctors at CORE. Regarding the extracorporeal shockwave therapy and reading that, everything just kind of, you know, with the treatment of using it for stump neuromas, et cetera, that it can decrease pain, but it doesn't actually shrink the size of a neuroma, is what I gather. You know, is what it, right. So I don't believe that there was any indication that there was an interdigital neuroma.
No, there was. There
and of course, and there were no, you know, MRs or anything, diagnostic ultrasound, right, to indicate that those would be present. So I'm curious as to, again, and we can ask the doctor why he selected that as a conservative option to treat the patient with. So. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. So, Dr. Bangart and Mr. Souders, please, sir.
And Madam Chair, I believe that SB is present, the complainant.
Did I miss something? Oh, yes, you did. Okay, sorry, gentlemen, before we're all, and she is present here in the room, correct? Oh, ma'am, you can, if you please, and we will refer to you by your, obviously, your initials, SB. Make yourself comfortable, and then if you would just kind of summarize your complaint for us.
I went to Dr. Bangart for treatment of my small toe. I had a callus, and it was very, very painful. And he did treat it for me, and I had to go back and take another treatment. Dr. Bangart told me that sometimes calluses go deep because I couldn't understand, you know, why it was so bad. I do have on that fifth toe, it does pronate, so I am walking on the side of it. It's been like that a long time. Then there was a proposal to do this ligament procedure that would supposedly straighten my toes, although I didn't see, personally, hammer toe. I do have one on my right foot. And so at any rate, I agreed to the procedure, thinking that he's the doctor, he knows what he's doing, he can certainly recommend something that I can do to possibly get this toe, to the little one, to straighten out so I'm not walking on the side of it anymore. So the procedure was done, cut the tendons underneath the toes, it was index, middle, and the fourth toe. It didn't work. I ended up with a bigger problem now than I had when I went in initially, because I have pain primarily in my middle toe. It feels to me like there's no cushioning under it anymore, and so when I am barefoot, which is not very often, but when I am barefoot, I'm stepping down into my patio area, and I'm getting into my patio shoes. So I am on painted concrete for a brief period of time, and I can feel it's painful, the middle toe, when I step down, or if I'm walking around one of the community swimming pools, which is concrete. Walking on concrete, I feel that pain. I don't know what's causing it to this day. I still don't know what my problem is as far as feeling this pain and this discomfort. I did go to Core Institute. That's the reason I canceled the Piazzo. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I wanted to see if there was something that could be done to correct the situation. I was told I'd have to have pins put in my toe. I have not done that. I'm really at a loss as to exactly what the problem is. And I just felt that I should bring this before the board because I feel like I was talked into a procedure that I really didn't need, considering what my initial problem was. It's been causing me a lot of trouble. And I have pictures. They are not dated. I took them myself. It was before before the pedicure after the surgery. So this is probably 5 to 6 weeks. But these two toes, this toe, the index toe or second toe, the middle toe, this is the one that's so painful on the back side of it. But they tip up. And they never tipped up at that last joint before. And I did ask Dr. Bangart what do you do? It's tipping. Never did that before. So he put a Band-Aid on it, This is not the Band-Aid that he put on. So I learned how to put a Band-Aid. I didn't do it very well. If it's done properly, it does straighten the toe so that joint isn't sticking out. That's pretty much it.
I have a few questions. So did Dr. Bangart offer you any other non-surgical treatment? Well, the, you know, the debridement of the keratosis and the using of the silver nitrate, is, you know, that's a very common treatment for a porokeratosis. But did he explain to you underneath that if that was coming from the spur, the bump on the bone, or any show you the x-rays or anything? And did he did you ever any discussion about maybe an orthotic, something to balance your foot and help possibly give a little, you know, derotation and decrease the pronation of the fifth toe?
He gave me a suggestion of and gave me a coupon to go to a store that sells like a wider box shoe.
That's. And at that time, prior to, were you having that feeling on the bottom of your foot that you didn't have enough cushion?
I had no feeling until after the surgery. And now I'm always aware of these toes, the two that give me primarily the most discomfort. They ache at the end of the day if I'm on my feet a long period of time, because I'm a fairly active person, walk my dog twice a day. If I'm doing any kind of shopping with my friends and I'm on my feet long enough that it's I can feel, even with the paresthesia, which I still have, I'm aware of these two particular toes. I'm aware of them. And
are you getting any electrical sensations, anything that shoots up your foot and leg?
No, not really. It's just a aching and a discomfort. And depending on if I'm barefoot in the way I step down, onto a surface that's not padded and I don't have shoes on, I get, you know, it's very painful.
And you?
Yes, it's the nerve. I don't know.
And you're not a diabetic? You don't have any autoimmune type illnesses?
Prior to seeing Dr. Bangard, did you see another doctor with this problem or anybody else?
No, I just called my primary care and told him I was having problems with this callus. And he gave the recommendation.
Were you having any pain in the other toes besides the fifth toe?
I have a bunion on my right foot, but it's manageable. I had not considered having surgery on it. It's still there.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. We appreciate that. Oh, Mr. Sauter, Dr. Bangard, please.
Well, we provided a supplement, and I apologize. I used the wrong patient's initials in the body of it, and Sprotus and I talked about it, but the supplement's accurate and pertains to this case, and hopefully you had a chance to look at the literature that supports the therapy that was suggested by Dr. Banger. After listening to Dr. Prokhorov and SB speak, I think I understand my role here. So I understand what you think it is. Dr. Bangard's probably best suited to answer any questions you have. He does have his notes. I know he feels like in this instance he offered conservative care, and certainly his care didn't close the door and didn't necessitate any of the care that SB received in the future or Institute. Where the conservative care was offered to avoid more complicated procedures were potentially more complicated.
Why did you decide to do the second through fifth toes?
That's a good question, and I often will have patients answer that. And I know that, or when I see patients with these deformities, I have them plantar flex their toes. And again, I'm trying to maintain that balance. There are times where just, you know, two, three, and four will move, and not the fifth quite as much. There's times where all of them will move. So my goal is to maintain that balance. I've seen other hammer toe procedure, you have an isolated arthroplasty or one done, and that one's straight, and the others are like this, and they have further problems. So my goal is to keep a plantigrade rectus toe to help with propulsion. And so on clinical exam, if I see that they're all moving together, my goal is to not cause further issues later on. Again, I've had good success doing this procedure. I like this procedure because it is a quick healing time with, you know, little to no swelling, and allows patients to achieve that result that they want. Again, understanding, ask questions or answer questions about the other issues. That's why I address toes, the other two, three, and four.
You took X-rays of that fifth toe?
Yes.
Did you see a spur on that fifth toe?
Going back to my note, forgive me, I always will show the X-rays to my patients and on their first visits. And yes, I did notice I label it as hypertrophic bone on involving the distal phalanx of the fifth toes bilaterally. But I will always show them and kind of give them a basic rundown. I try not to overload them with much information, but enough that they can understand and give them their options.
Was there any discussion that the spur might be causing the pain and how to treat it?
In these instances where I see that, you know, that's a common area we know for a poor keratosis or a callus where there's a spur on a varus rotated toe, that yes, I will, you know, there's an underlying spur. But I also understand that there are spurs on other parts of the body that have, you know, there's a callus not necessarily causing pain. We don't just go after the spur. My goal is a lot of times to see if we can improve the contracture and the curvature and then give the skin time to respond.
Were you able to discuss with the patient that this could take multiple surgeries? The toe, perhaps if it doesn't work?
Yes, I give them that when I discuss the hammer toe procedure, when I give them options, I talk about the flexor tenotomies and or capsulotomies, but I also talk about doing arthroplasties. And my rationale is if I can manually straighten the toe, there's not a rigid contracture, my goal is to maintain that length of the toe and just do a musculotendinous balancing procedure, which is, in my opinion, much more effective without causing some of the other complications that can occur from arthroplasty-type procedures. I also understand that that's still, like, we haven't burned any bridges. There are times where we have to go on and do that, but more often than not, I give the patients that option. I explained to them, too, like, I've had this procedure done to my toes, and so I've been there, had toe pain, and I understand to a point what this recovery and is like. Does that answer your question?
I have no further questions.
Did you consider, you know, an exostectomy of that spur plus a derotational skin plasty as a possibility for that instead of, because that's where her primary complaint was? Because, and I think sometimes you invite, you know, when you do surgery, I mean, you've done it. You can't go back and start again. And you, as you know, you progress onto other surgeries. So, I mean, keep the old KISS principle of keep it simple, stupid, Stanley or whatever name you want to pick. That's an old tried and true procedure, and it often works. And that's where her complaint was, and that's where I have a problem. And I understand biomechanics, and, you know, and the ability to then, you know, maybe an ortho, you know, an orthotic device would have helped late, you know, later. And you may have eventually had to go on to do other things. I just think starting basic and simple, seeing how it progresses, because again, that's where the patient's complaint was. That's my issue.
Can I make a?
Yes.
And I realize that's a legitimate thought process, which I'll have that process as well. You mentioned too that there are times where, you know, surgery's irreversible. Once you make a change, there's a change. I've had very good success doing this procedure. Does it work all the time? No. Does any surgery work all the time? It does not. I always like to try the simple things that does not affect their lifestyle. As far as that corn, could I have gone back and done that? Yes, I probably would have done that. And my goal is not to drag this process out, but if in my experience that it were off not just doing those simpler tendon balancing procedures works more often than not, then that's what I would want done to me or a family member. And so I recommend that first, because again, with doing a derotational skin plasty, working on bone, your, you know, bigger incisions, different complications that occur with bigger incisions, and you know, we're trying to rely on how the body reacts when we're doing skin plasties. And at times, you know, whether it's a removing bone, that is painful. And so, again, the goal is to, in regards to the toe, to help that. That's
comment to that. And certainly appreciate your viewpoint. Mr. Rhodes, do you have any questions, sir?
No, I'm listening.
Okay. Well, I don't think this, to me, does not lead to anything that shows that there's a violation of state statute. But again, I think my concern goes back to addressing the chief complaint. And again, I know we all, you know, you have your own, your knowledge base, what's worked in your hands, what's your, you know, history of what you've done for patients and their results, et cetera, all come into play. But that's my, where I sit on this.
And I realized too, excuse me, just, I mean, again, I use myself a lot with my patients. I've had 33 operations throughout my life, from sports injuries to just didn't pick my parents carefully enough when it came to my genetics, you know. And so I understand that surgery is not without risk. I've had post-op complications in multiple different areas. And, you know, and again, my whole goal is to treat patients how I would treat a family member that I like, and help them get better. And again, I explained to them there's a process to getting better. Hindsight is always perfect. If I had a chance to talk to patient SB right now, and if I could look and say, yeah, I would have gone after that hypertrophic bone and the skin, and then hopefully there wouldn't be a painful scar or callus from that, you know, that derotational arthroplasty.
That's one of my concerns also, was the fifth toe was the main complaint. Mm-hmm. The second, third, and fourth was also addressed.
Correct.
With that. I would have, my thinking would have kind of been different. Sure.
I mean, Mark or Dr. Foreman, please.
No, I understand. Minimal invasive surgery, we try to do the most possible. Balancing the toes. Probably would have done the mastectomy at the same time with the incision. I understand he was trying to lift it up.
So, you know, again, I'm going to just offer that we, or make a motion that we offer a letter of concern regarding maybe just think, discussing maybe more too pre-op with your patient, you know, these different, you know, be a little bit more option and making sure everybody is on the same page with what's going on and directing treatment more towards chief complaints. Second on that?
I second that.
Further discussion? All in favor?
No. Aye.
Aye. Okay. Anyone opposed? So moved. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Would you all like to take a 10-minute break? Heather? Take a 10-minute break. All right, we're going to go back in session at 3:17. We have our next case, which is 19-23-C. Dr. Devin Bland, his attorney, Mr. Flynn Carey, is present. This is an ongoing, we participated in the special meeting. Heather, what day was our teleconference? 19th?
December 19th, yes. Sure. This was opened because Dr. Bland self-reported a DUI, and the board voted to table the initial complaint to allow the court to make a determination. So a few weeks ago, I received correspondence from Dr. Bland's attorney, Mr. Carey, and the court has dismissed the case. So now I'm bringing it back to the board just to see what the board would like to do at this point.
Thank you, Jill. And Mr. Carey, were there negotiations made to resolve the case? Because we all really all read that there was, it was that the officer involved didn't. There was not a, how many the words are moving into that? There was flaws in the investigation.
Yes, President Campbell, members of the board, there was a constitutional violation here. Actually, what ended up happening is Mr. Bland, or Dr. Bland, would have an opportunity to gather evidence of his own once an accusation of DUI has been made. The officer denied the right for him to gather that information, so he was not able to present information that he was not impaired and that he did not have a blood alcohol level, as argued by law enforcement. And in fact, I practice, part of my practice is criminal here. It is very rare that I see a joinder or a agreement by the state that there was an unreasonable interference in his right to counsel and his right to gather exculpatory information. The reason the remedy is a dismissal is because it prevents, blood alcohol is ephemeral. It dissipates very quickly over time. He was essentially denied a constitutional right to be able to be retested. And that is such a significant constitutional violation that the state did not determine that it should be going forward in the interest of justice. And so this is one of those cases, which is rare, where the state agrees that there was a significant violation of such magnitude that it needed to be dismissed. So as we stand right now, it was a dismissal with prejudice. It will not be brought back. What I would also note is that our request would be of the board to dismiss on this one because there are some concerns surrounding other things that had happened this evening generated by the Tuba City Hospital. There is a vehicle by which to address that through that other complaint. Our deadline to respond on that one isn't until the 29th.
Correct.
So that's still pending. So I think just from administrative convenience, one way to handle this would be to dismiss the current pending 23 complaint, allow us to respond on 29 in detail, which we have not had the opportunity to do yet, and then that can be obviously looked at that time so we can get a little further into the weeds on some of those issues.
And, you know, in regards, my comment will be made regarding the other situation we'll be discussing. So, yes, that is quite appropriate. So,
I'll make a motion to this. 23-C.
I'll second it.
Any discussion? Mr. Rhodes, any discussion? Okay. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Mr. Rhodes, did you hear me? We have to have quorum.
Aye.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. All right. It's been moved and seconded to dismiss case 19-23-C, seeing no violation of state statute.
Dr. Campbell, if I may, I don't want to go out of order, but the motion that we had filed on the 40 matter, it is the request we had made is procedural in nature. So under your inherent powers, would the board entertain, before we get into the substance on that complaint, having some discussion on the procedural issues that we've raised? I think it's a threshold issue before we actually get into the discussion of the actual case.
I mean, I think, you know, we've moved, it's been, you know, the motion was made to dismiss the 19-23-C, moved, seconded, and unanimously voted to dismiss, and then we are going to move on to the next case.
Thank you.
That's what you were asking, yeah. All right, so we are moving on then to the other case, which is the 19-40-C. And the procedural thing, I read, Mr. Carey, your concerns in your letter to the board, and Dr. Bland is licensed by this board. It is his responsibility to, to have communication with our board. We're not here to be the jurisdiction for either Indian Health Services or anybody else. And I understand you're saying that they do an omnibus response and the doctor thought that all he has to do is his responsibility, is that they take care of it, but he's still a licensee of this state. It is his responsibility to respond to any board question in the applicable time frame. The other comment I'd like to make on that is the Joint Commission report, again, has nothing, it can be used, yes, by us as a separate investigation report as part of materials collected, but it's a supplement. It does not, it has to be, it's part of the subpoenaed records. And we're the ones that determined if a state statute was violated, not the Joint Commission.
I understand that. And our concern is that in previous complaints, when he was employed by Tuba City did with the doctor to provide a response. In fact, the compliance officer often would be on the phone with Ms. Broaddus and Mr. Bland together to address those complaints. The reason we're asking for a brief extension so that we can respond more fully is council received notice of this in early January, not enough time for us to get an expert on board to provide a detailed response here. What we're trying to avoid is a situation in which there is we go forward to a hearing of some manner when we may be able to answer a lot of the questions that the board has. We're not asking for a significant amount of time. I received notice of this personally, that it was going to be agendized in early January, immediately got with the board and filed our letter of request. We're simply asking for an opportunity. This happened at the same time as other complaints pending. I think there is it is something that we asked the board to determine is excusable, that it was not responded to, and I would think that the board would want a comprehensive response so that when they ask questions of Dr. Bland, they can ask those questions in great detail. Some of the things that I would just draw the board's attention to is we don't believe that the records that were disclosed are complete. We believe that Dr. Bland should also have the benefit of a complete medical record, as should his expert, so he can fully respond. I'm concerned as well that this is someone who, and I don't want to get into too much detail at this stage since we're still talking more procedurally, but this is someone who the records reflect did not appear as required for appointments. There are internal records of Tuba City that would indicate that Dr. Bland was not scheduled on the dates. He was scheduled to be out of town on the dates where abandonment is being alleged. There are a significant number of factors here on a complicated standard of care case. I think, and also would recognize that this is over a year old. The actual surgery that occurred was a 2018 case of surgery. I think it is inequitable for Dr. Bland to have to rely on his memory, as he's no longer employed by Tuba City, to be able to respond here. So we are not asking for a free pass, but we are asking for a mechanism by which he can provide a comprehensive response to the report.
And, you know, Mike, I have a question for you. Why do you believe it's necessary to have a report done by, you know, this isn't a court situation. It's not like you have an expert witness. So, if we were, Heather, I believe, we received all medical records, correct?
According to Tuba City, if there's a specific report or a specific date of notes or anything like that that you believe are missing, I can address that specifically with Tuba City.
There are x-rays that are not available, that were not made available. In addition, there was the Joint Commission there was an investigation that was done internally that is clearly relevant to the patient. I would encourage the board, if you can ask Ms. Broaddus, this is not out of the ordinary for Tuba City. There are instances where Tuba City does not disclose everything, and when they do disclose things, they disclose things at a very slow pace. We have some concerns. I mean, we can't look at x-rays. We don't have x-rays to be able to review. We have limited records right now, and that is problematic for us to be able to defend Dr. Bland on these allegations, and I think the board would be in a better position if it could say when it makes its decision that it has the comprehensive file. And I certainly understand, Dr. Campbell, you're concerned about the Joint Commission, but if we have other data points, if we have the benefit of a free look at this case through another investigative agency, I think that would certainly be something the board would want to see, because I think it would give value. We have Dr. Polakoff. If we have another data point indicating that this was not substantiated, I understand statutorily, but the standard of care doesn't change simply because whether it's under a statute or not, they're looking at the same standard of care for treatment. And I think that would be extremely valuable to be able to have that extra data point. And then as to our expert, it is yet another data point for this board to consider, especially given the nature of the allegations. I think that the cost benefit here of a brief extension of time compared to the harm that could befall Dr. Bland or the adjudication of this case really factors in favor of a brief continuance.
Mark?
It's entirely within the discretion of the board. The most important thing is, do you believe you have all the information necessary to make an informed decision? And you have to balance that with making sure that the licensee has been afforded every opportunity to adequately and competently defend himself of the allegations of unprofessional conduct.
And for us, the confounding factor in this case is he was a W-2 employee of Tuba City when the surgery occurred. He was a W-2 when the complaint came out. I understand and I have educated him now as to the process by which, how the track the board occupies. But this is a situation where had he responded while he was employed, he could have likely been terminated for having that level of contact without approval or without acknowledgement by Tuba City. It would not be out of the ordinary for a chief compliance officer to require participation of a licensee, and their job can at times be conditioned on it. So I think he followed what he was taught, and he followed what the practice was with Tuba City. He is separated from Tuba City at this time, and it would be an opportunity for him to respond now on his own, now armed with the knowledge that requirement is separate. But that's what we're seeking, is an opportunity to have a full discourse, with this board on this issue.
So, Heather, then we need to make sure that we have everything. Double check medical records and make sure that everything is available. And you never know how, you know, that, you know, are we looking at, you think that it would be feasible to be ready next month, or?
I would suggest two things. First of all, I have model language if the board would want it in regards to a request to Ms. Broaddus for documentation, seeking documentation. Second of all, I would say 60 days, and the only reason I would say 60 days is my familiarity with some of the smaller hospitals and my familiarity with Tuba City is that there are lags, and I would not want a situation where we're reconvening with the IME and creating a situation where we can't make forward progress. So I would suggest 60 days. I serve at the pleasure of the board. If you tell me 30 days, we will get you a response in that time.
That's true.
I would get the continuance.
A time frame that we're discussing. Do you think, Mr. Rhodes, do you have any remarks?
No, I think 60 days is fair.
Okay, so then I will make a motion to allow to continue this case, giving opportunity for Dr. Bland and have time to review. Make sure he has time to review all pertinent medical records regarding this case. And can we hold that thought? I forgot to ask you, do we have the complainant on the phone?
Yes, she's.
I'm here.
I'm sorry.
I'm here.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. I know you've been listening in, so we do appreciate you participating, but at this time, because we're going to continue this case, Heather can inform you of when that will occur so you could participate again telephonically at that time. Does that seem, that's the reasonable thing I can offer you.
That's fine.
Okay, great. Well, then we'll do that. So thank you so much.
Actually, you said 60 days.
Well, that's the time frame we're going to try to work with. So Ms. Brodus will contact you, okay? She will get in touch with you when that has been agendized on a meeting date, okay? Thank you.
Okay.
So it's been moved and seconded.
Seconded.
To continue this investigation for case 19-40-C. We have giving Dr. Bland and Mr. Carey 60 days to complete a review of materials. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Righty. Okay. So that concludes our files for investigation. Let's move back to under 5A. We have an update of investigators review an audit report. Done by Dr. Polakoff for Dr. Patrick Farrell. The complaint number is 18-08-C. Is Ms. Kent here yet? No, she's not. Oh, she won't. Is Ms. Gingrich going to be here? Okay. Dr. Polakoff, if you want to come and give your... And then we have Dr. Farrell, who we'll talk with after Dr. Polakoff reports.
Good morning, Board. It's Dr. Polakoff on 1808C chart audit on Patrick Farrell, DPM. I did review the chart audit. Two cases were chosen to audit, MC and GL. In both cases, I found that the documentation needs some improvement. An example is in the neurological exam, it's a conclusion for stating neuritis, but it's not subjective as to what the neuritis is, where it is, and why he has that diagnosis, except in for patient MC in the third visit. Then we finally get down to some of the specifics for the neurological exam. So an improvement for his record keeping in the future is... in the exam, don't make a conclusion. So a conclusion is made of neuritis and its components, but the records are missing objective findings. In both cases, MCNGL, documentation for podiatric encounter is weak. There's a lot of carryover each visits. The important issues for diabetic patients are weak and not documented. Vascular exams should be charted on each visit. Neurological detent and reflexes, Stein-Weinstein probe findings each visit. Again, in the neurological description, findings of the actual subjective and objective responses by the patient. In MC, I did have a question, were x-rays done? It appears from the notes that the nerve decompressions were appropriate, and it was reported an 80 to 90% improvement of both patients, MC and GL. In patient MC, she was experiencing right heel pain for many years, previously treated in Mexico with cortisone injections. There was a limb length irregularity with the right being greater than left. Neurological exam, neuritis, medial calcaneal neuritis right. Assessment was unequal limb length, plantar fascial fibromatosis, an unspecific mononeuropathy of the right lower extremity. And the plan at that first visit was to perform an injection. 2 months later, she had an additional injection. The x-rays were negative for fracture when she went to the ER for severe pain. She was diagnosed with a sprain and given a cam walker. An injection was given by Dr. Farrell into the tibial nerve right. If not better, they were going to go to a EMG, which I found very appropriate. And the next month, little improvement. The patient did have an EMG, and it showed a mild sciatic neuropathy on the right without ongoing denervation over a mild peripheral neuropathy. There's no clear electrodiagnostic evidence of any other tarsal tunnel syndrome. On 10/24, 10 over 10 pain, reduced velocity of the right lateral. The doctor recommended surgery for the right tarsal tunnel release. November 14th, 2019, surgery was performed. And tarsal tunnel release on the right. On December 2nd, extremely painful. She was non-weight bearing. December 10th, the area was itchy. Sensation was 90% improved. The findings in both cases submitted under neurological, as I said, is more of a diagnosis as to objective findings. In both cases, documentation for the podiatric encounter is weak. And I still question if x-rays were done on MC, and if so, I did not receive them. For patient GL, a 62-year-old diabetic, neurological exam was improved in the documentation than the first patient. The left tibial motor and right tibial motor nerves show decreased conduction velocity. And the impression was mild to moderate L4 to 5 radiculopathy on the right without ongoing degeneration, and this report was from, I believe, the EMG. The patient did have a better report on the findings, the pulses, the neurological examination, Sims-Weinstein monofilament testing is positive. The surgery on MGL was tarsal tunnel syndrome diagnosis and anterior tarsal tunnel syndrome decompression of the deep and superficial peroneal nerves. Post-op appeared to be normal, and she had an 80% improvement. In reviewing of the billing on patient GL, during the first visit of 6/3/2019, she was given a prescription for Lamisil, but she was not given labs until she returned until 6/28/2019. I question the timeliness of the labs, which I would have, in my practice and years of practice, I would have done before I prescribed the Lamisil, as opposed to waiting for 3 weeks later to see how she was doing. In the 10/9/2019 visit, there was a billing of a 99215, and in 10/1/2019, there was a billing of 99214. to get a 99214 E&M code, we need 15-plus bullet points. There were 15-plus bullet points on the page, but the podiatric information was weak. In 99215, you need 20-plus bullet points, and this was a full H&P prior to surgery. There were 20 points if you do include the heart evaluation, the breast examination, ears, eyes, etc. A tarsal tunnel decompression was performed on 10/18/19 and billed, as well as a decompression unspecified nerve. So a 28035 was the primary surgery, followed by a 64722 unspecified nerve. Both procedures were repeated on 12/27 for 28035, and then again a 64708 nerve major peripheral release. And then on 12/27/19, on patient GL, removal of implant 20680. And I am unclear as to what implant was removed. As of this time, in review, I find that documentation needs to be improved, billing needs to be explained, and that's about it. Any questions?
Prior to this, were the removal of the implant, there was no mention of implant in his notes?
Not that I gathered.
Okay. And where was the implant removed?
I don't know.
Okay.
A billing question. Every coding seminar I've been to, the bill above the 99214. Because you can't do, based upon a license, we're not able to do the exams. Is that the case?
According to the AMA billing coders guideline, to bill a 99215, that's exceptional. Just an example, even the Mayo Clinic, who loves 99215s and anything with a 5 at the end, has cut it down to a 4 because justification for billing 5 is really hard to achieve. If you are in a specialty, it's very difficult to get a 5. If you are primary care, you can't actually get all the bullet points in there. In order to get all the bullet points and to get a 5 visit, you do have a 45-minute visit for time-wise, and that's one bullet point. You do have to get all the areas and your expertise. In the podiatric field, in some states, they do have a special sub-license that is given for podiatric histories and physicals. Arizona is not one of those licenses. An example is in Illinois and in Georgia. I can do a complete physical on a patient once I achieve this extra addition to my license. That means I have had extra education on how to do a complete physical, listening to heart murmurs, a breast exam, everything, eye, ears, nose, everything that is required. But in the day-to-day practice, doing a 5 in any specialty is almost unheard of. In a primary, you can do it. Thank you, Board.
Thank you.
So, anybody else have any other questions? Mr. Rhodes, did you have any questions for Dr. Polakoff?
No.
Thank you. All right. So, Dr. Farrell. Yeah.
Hi. Patrick Farrell.
Okay, so questions for you here. Gentlemen, Mark or Dr. Furman, please, do you have any questions for Dr. Farrell?
I have a question about the 99215.
I spent about an hour with that patient that day. You want to know about the implant? It was a four-hole plate that was holding the talonavicular fusion from 1978 or something that was in there. So it's cruising plate. The forget what the code was, but it's just for removal of an implant, which is screws and plates are an implant into the foot. I do a complete physical. I did get certified through my residency. That was 33 years ago in Illinois. And she says Illinois has the right to do physicals. I do a complete physical. I do the whole system. I'm working on getting my documentation better, and this is part of why I'm up here today, is because of my documentation has been faulty, and I failed to do an EMG nerve conduction study on one of my patients, and that's why they've asked me to submit these nerve conductions or these nerve surgeries for you. The nerve conduction studies are necessary to show that you have an entrapped nerve, but they also have a high degree of false negatives. Clinically, if I inject somebody with the local anesthetic and a steroid and their pain goes away, I don't think it would go away because of a radiculopathy or a sciatica, okay? But the nerve conduction studies pointing to sciatica as one of the problems with this. When I do the surgery and they respond from that surgery and they get better from that surgery, how's that related to sciatica? So there's a false negative in EMG nerve conduction studies, but medical legally, they're required.
It looks like both of them have responded well, though, to your to the treatment here. Why did you wait on the one patient to do your liver profile while treatment had already been started?
The FDA requires you to check their liver at 6 weeks. That's the FDA requirement.
But not pre-treatment?
No, they do not require during pre-treatment.
So you felt comfortable with that given the patient's medical history?
She's not a drinker. She doesn't take nephrotoxic she doesn't take drugs that are potentially dangerous to her liver.
And there was, again, which patient was, I have to look in my notes a little clearer, that the neurologist had recommended testing for an autonomic or small fiber neuropathy. Do you do the small fiber biopsies?
Sometimes I'll do those on the sural nerve.
That was on GL.
Okay. But I didn't do it on this patient. Clinically, I felt she had what I suspected, and postoperatively, she responded to the surgery.
Anybody else has anything, just jump in.
Sure. Getting back to your office visits, 99214, 99215, your limited scope of practice in Arizona, where you're doing, as I understand it, you're doing breast exams. And
right. Well, I'll review my billing and I'll back off the 215s. I still will do an examination of my patients. I found in my examination I can do other referrals to the pulmonologist on their lungs, to the cardiologist because of their heart arrhythmias, and even on the breast, sending them to the general surgeon for biopsies or mammograms.
Would it be appropriate to send them to their primary care for them to do those exams?
But if I know that primary care is probably going to send them to these, but taking past a step and sending them right to the pulmonologist, it saves my patients time and gets them to where they need to be right away.
Problem that I have, what if you miss something and you weren't properly trained to see these things that a patient has?
I do refer my patients to their primary care doctors quite a bit, and the primary care doctors refer their patients to me. So,
refer them to you for breast exams or
no, for their
foot
and ankle problems.
Do you have a female medical assistant present with you when you do these full HMPs on the female patients?
I usually do. I'm not doing a breast exam.
You're not doing gynae exams, are you?
Huh?
You're not doing a vaginal exam, are you?
No. And I'm not doing rectals.
I would like to move into for purposes of advice.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor? Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Okay. We, y'all remain here and we'll be back.
Do you have something to say?
Mr. Rhodes?
Yes.
Can you just call him on the cell phone?
Do you want to explain that to
us to just leave?
No, you just stay here. We're going to go into another room.